beer.
You mean you didn't know? Too busy talking to nutcases in railroad tunnels, I guess.
Smithback glanced back at the reporter, struggling to conceal his surprise. Was this some kind of false lead? But no. The cool eyes behind the tortoiseshell glasses were scornful, but serious.
Haven't been able to find that out yet, he said guardedly. You don't say.
Harriman slapped him on the back.
$100,000 reward, huh? That might just pay your salary for the next 2 years, if the Post doesn't go belly up again.
He laughed, dropped a $5 bill on the counter, and turned to go. Smithback watched Harriman's retreating back with irritation. So the bodies have been moved from the medical examiner's office. He should have learned that himself. But where? There had been no funeral arrangements, no burial. They must be in a lab somewhere. A lab with better equipment than the NYME. Someplace secure, not like Columbia or Rockefeller University with students wandering around everywhere. After all, Lieutenant DeGosta was in charge of the case. He was a cool customer, Smithback knew, not the kind of guy to do something rash. Why would DeGosta move the bodies?
DeGosta.
Suddenly, Smithback guessed. No, he knew where the bodies must be. Draining his glass, he slid off the stool and moved across the plush red carpet to a bank of phones in the front foyer. Dropping a quarter in the nearest one, he dialed a number.
Curly here, said a voice thick with age.
Curly, said Smithback. It's Bill Smithback. How you doing?
Fine, Dr. Smithback. Haven't seen you around for a while.
Curly, who checked badges at the staff entrance to the Museum of Natural History, called everyone doctor. Princes lived and died. Dynasties rose and fell. But Curly, Smithback knew, would remain in his ornate bronze pillbox, checking IDs forever.
Now, Curly, what time on Wednesday night did those ambulances come in? You know, the two that drove in together?
Smithback spoke fast, praying that the old guard didn't know he'd become a reporter after leaving his writing assignment at the museum.
Well, let's see,
Curly said in his unhurried way.
Can't say I remember anything like that, Doctor.
Really? Smithback asked, crestfallen. He'd been absolutely sure.
Not unless you mean that one that came in with the lights and sirens off. But that was early Thursday, not Wednesday.
Smithback could hear Curly rustling through his log.
Yep, just after 5 a.m. it was.
That's right, Thursday. What was I thinking of?
Smithback thanked Curly and hung up exultantly. Grinning, he returned to the bar. With one phone call, he'd discovered what Harriman had no doubt been searching for, unsuccessfully, for days. It made perfect sense. He knew that DeGosta had used the museum's laboratory on other cases, not least of all the museum beast murders. It was a high-security lab in a high-security museum. No doubt he'd have called in that pompous old curator, Frock, and maybe Frock's ex-assistant, Margot Green, Smithback's own friend from his days at the museum.
Margot Green,
Smithback thought. That merited some looking into. He called the bartender over.
Patty, I think I'll stay on Isla, but switch distilleries. Lefroy, please. The 15-year-old.
He took a sip of the marvelous whiskey. $10 a shot, but worth every penny.
$100,000 might just pay your salary for the next 2 years,
Harriman had teased. Smithback decided that, after the next front-page story, he'd have to hit Murray up for a raise. Nothing like striking while the iron was hot. 11. Sergeant Hayward descended a long metal staircase, opened a narrow door filmed in brown rust, and stepped out onto an abandoned railroad siding. Behind her, DeGosta emerged from the doorway, hands in pockets. Murky sunlight filtered down through a series of gratings far above their heads, illuminating dust motes in the still air. DeGosta looked first left, then right. In both directions, the tracks dissolved into the gloom of the tunnel. He He noticed that Hayward had an unusual way of moving below ground, a kind of silent, wary step.
"Where's the captain?" Hayward asked.
"He's coming," said DaGosta, scraping the underside of his heel on the metal rail of the siding. "You go ahead."
He watched Hayward move cat-like down the tunnel, her flashlight throwing a narrow beam into the darkness ahead. Any hesitation he felt at letting this petite woman lead the way had evaporated as he watched the ease with which she handled herself underground. Waxy, on the other hand, had slowed considerably in the 2 hours since they'd visited the brownstone basement where the first body had been found more than 3 months before. It was a damp room, crammed with old boilers. Rotting wires dangled from the ceiling. Hayward had pointed out the mattress tucked behind a blackened furnace, littered with empty plastic water bottles and torn newspapers, the dead man's living space. There was an old bloodstain on the mattress, 3 feet in diameter, heavily chewed on by rats. Above it, a pair of ragged athletic socks were draped over a pipe, covered in a furry mantle of green mold. The body found there had been Hank Jasper, Hayward said. No witnesses, no known relatives or friends. The case file had been equally useless. No photographs or scene reports, just some routine paperwork, a brief report referring to extensive lacerations and a badly crushed skull and the notice of a quick burial at Potter's Field on Hart Island. Nor had they found much of anything in the defunct Columbus Circle Station bathroom where the second body had been discovered. A lot of trash and a half-hearted attempt to clean up the red blizzard of blood that clung to the ancient tile sinks and cracked mirrors. No ID on that one at all. The head was missing. There was a stifled curse behind him, and DaGosta turned to see the round form of Captain Waxy emerging from the rusted door. He looked around distastefully, his pasty visage shining unnaturally in the half-light.
"Jesus, Vinny," he said, picking his way over the tracks toward DaGosta. "What the hell are we doing? I told you before, this isn't any job for a police captain, especially on a Sunday afternoon."
He nodded his head in the direction of the dark tunnel. "That cute little thing put you up to this, didn't she? Amazing set of knockers. You know, I offered her a job as my personal assistant. Instead, she chose to stay on rousting detail, dragging bums out of holes. Go figure."
"Funny thing about that," DaGosta thought, imagining what life under Waxy would be like for a woman as attractive as Hayward.
"And now my damn radio's gone on the fritz," Waxy said irritably.
DaGosta pointed upward. "Hayward tells me they don't work on the ground. Not reliably, anyway."
"Great. How are we supposed to call for backup?"
"We don't. We're on our own."
"Great,"
Waxy repeated. DaGosta looked at Waxy. Beads of sweat had sprung up along his upper lip, and his dough-colored jowls, usually firm, were starting to sag.
"This is your jurisdiction, not mine," DaGosta said. "Just think how good it will make you look if this turns out to be big. Taking charge right away, visiting the scene personally, for a change."
He fingered his jacket pocket for a cigar, then decided against it.
"And think how bad it will look if these deaths are connected somehow, and the press starts talking about how you just looked the other way."
Waxy scowled at him.
"I'm not running for mayor, Vinny."
"I'm not talking about being mayor. All I know is when the rain of shit begins to fall like it always does, your ass will be covered."
Waxy grunted, looking somewhat mollified. DaGosta could see Hayward's light playing down the tracks toward them, and soon the woman appeared again out of the gloom.
"Almost there," she said. "It's one more down." "Down?" said Waxy. "Sergeant, I thought this was the lowest level."
Hayward said nothing.
"So, how are we supposed to go down?" DaGosta asked her.
Hayward nodded in the direction from which she'd come. "North along the tracks, about 400 yards, there's another staircase along the right wall."
"What if a train comes?" Waxy asked.
"This is a deserted stem," Hayward said. "No trains have come along here in a long time."
"How do you know?"
Hayward silently played her beam along the rails beneath their feet, illuminating the thick orange rust. DaGosta's eyes traveled up the flashlight beam until they reached Hayward's face. She did not look very happy.
"Is there anything unusual about the next level?" DaGosta asked quietly.
Hayward was silent for a moment.
Ordinarily, we only sweep the upper levels, but you hear stories. They get crazier the lower you go.
She paused.
That's why I suggested backup, she said pointedly.
People living down here?
Waxy asked, sparing DeGosta the necessity of a reply.
Of course.
Hayward made a face as if Waxy should know better.
Warm in the winter, no rain or wind. Only people they have to worry about down here are the other moles.
So when was the last time they rousted that level?
They don't roust the lower levels, Captain.
Why not?
There was a silence.
Well, for one thing, you can't find the deeper moles. They've got night vision, living in the dark. You hear something, and by the time you've turned around, they're gone. They only do a couple random sweeps a year with dogs trained to find bodies, and even they don't go that deep. Besides, it's very dangerous. Not all the moles come down here just for shelter. Some come to hide. Some are running from something. The law, usually. Still others are predatory.
What about that article in the Post? The Ghosta asked. It said there was some kind of underground community. Didn't sound all that hostile.
That was under Central Park, Lieutenant, not the West Side rail yards, Hayward said. Some areas are tamer than others. And don't forget that article mentioned something else. Something about cannibals?
She smiled sweetly. Waxy opened his mouth to respond, then closed it again, swallowing loudly.
They began moving down the tracks in silence. As they walked, DeGosta realized he was unconsciously fingering his S&W Model 4946 double action. Back in 93, there had been some controversy in the department about moving to a 9mm semi-automatic. Now DeGosta was glad he had it. The staircase, when they reached it, was fronted by a steel door canted at a crazy angle across the doorframe. Hayward pulled it open, then stepped aside. DeGosta stepped through and immediately felt his eyes begin to water. A smell like ammonia violated his nostrils. "I'll go first, Lieutenant," Hayward said.
DeGosta stepped aside. No argument there. The lime-coated staircase descended to a landing, then made a turn. DeGosta felt his watering eyes begin to sting. The smell was searing, indescribable.
"What the hell is that?" he asked.
"Piss," said Hayward matter-of-factly. "Mostly. Plus other things you don't want to hear about."
Behind them, Waxy's wheezing became more pronounced. They stepped through a ragged opening into a dark, humid space. As Hayward played her light about, DeGosta saw that they were in what looked like the cavernous end of an old tunnel. But there were no tracks here, just a rough, dirt floor scattered with pools of oil and water and the charred remains of small campfires. Garbage lay strewn everywhere. Old newspapers, a torn pair of pants, an old shoe, a plastic diaper, freshly soiled. DeGosta could hear Waxy blowing hard behind him. He was beginning to wonder why the captain had abruptly stopped complaining.
"Maybe it's the stench," he thought.
Hayward was moving toward a passage that led away from the cavern.
"Over here," she said. "The body was found in a cubby down this way. We'd better stay close. Watch out you don't get piped."
"Piped?"
the Ghosta asked.
"Someone reaches out from the dark and whacks you over the head with a pipe."
"I don't see anyone," the Ghosta said.
"They're here,"
Hayward replied. Waxy's breathing became more labored. They began following the passage, moving slowly. Hayward periodically pointed her light along the sides of the tunnel. Every 20 feet, a large, rectangular space had been cut into the rock. Work and storage areas, she explained, of railway crews a century before. Filthy bedding lay in many of the cubbyholes. Frequently, large brown rats, disturbed by the light, would stir among the trash, waddling away from the flashlight beams with insolent slowness. But there were no signs of people. Hayward stopped, removed her police cap, and drew a damp strand of hair back into place behind one ear.
"The report said it was the cubby directly across from a collapsed iron catwalk," she said.
DeGosta tried breathing through his hand, and when that didn't help, he loosened his tie and pulled his shirt collar over his mouth as a kind of mask.
"Here it is."
Hayward shone her beam on a rusted heap of iron struts and I-beams. She swept the flashlight across the tunnel, locating the cubby.
From the outside, it looked just like the others, 5 feet across, 3 feet deep, cut into the rock at about 2 feet above grade. DeGosta stepped closer and peered in. Naked bedding lay askew, caked thickly with dried blood. Blood was also spattered about the walls, along with bits of something that DeGosta didn't want to think about. There was the ubiquitous packing crate, tipped over and partly crushed. The floor of the cubby was paved with newspapers. The stench was beyond description.
"This guy," Hayward whispered, "was also found without his head. They identified him from prints. Shasheen Walker, 32 years old, rap sheet as long as your arm, a serious user."
At any other time, DeGosta would have found it ludicrous to hear a police officer whispering. Now he felt somehow glad. There was a long silence while DeGosta played his own light around.
"Did they find the head?" he asked at last.
"Nope," said Hayward.
The foul little den showed zero signs of a police search. Thinking he'd rather be anywhere else, doing anything else, DeGosta reached into the cubby, took hold of a corner of a filthy blanket, and jerked it back. Something brown tumbled out of the folds and rolled toward the nearest edge. What was left of its mouth was wide open in a frozen scream.
"I guess they didn't look too hard," DeGosta said.
He heard a small moan escape from Waxy.
"You okay, Jack?"
he asked, glancing back. Waxy said nothing. His face looked like a pale moon hovering in the noisome dark. DeGosta turned his light back on the head.
"We're gonna have to get an SOC team down here for a full series."
He reached for his radio, then remembered it wouldn't work. Hayward edged forward.
"Lieutenant?"
DeGosta paused.
"Yes?"
"The moles left this place alone because someone died in it. They're superstitious that way, some of them. But as soon as we leave, they're going to clean this whole mess up, get rid of the head themselves, and you'll never find it. More than anything else, they don't want cops down here."
"How the hell will they know we were here?"
"I keep telling you, Lieutenant, they're around, listening."
DeGosta shone his light about. The corridor was silent and dead.
"So what's your point?"
"If you want the head, you're going to have to take it with you."
"Shit," breathed DeGosta. "Okay, Sergeant. We'll have to improvise. Grab that towel over there."
Stepping in front of the motionless Waxy, Sergeant Hayward picked up the filthy, waterlogged towel and spread it on the damp concrete next to the head. Then, pulling the sleeve of her uniform over her hand, she nudged the head toward the towel with her wrist. DeGosta watched with mixed disgust and admiration as Hayward gathered the ends of the towel into a ball. He blinked his eyes, trying to wipe away the smart of the foul reek.
"Let's go. Sergeant, you may do the honors."
"No problem."
Hayward lifted the towel, holding it away from her body. As DeGosta stepped forward, shining his flashlight back down the corridor toward the staircase, there was a sudden whistling sound, and a bottle came winging out of the dark, just missing Waxy's head. It shattered loudly on the wall. Farther down the passageway, DeGosta could hear a rustling noise.
"Who's there?"
he yelled.
"Halt! Police officers!"
Another bottle came flying wildly out of the dark. DeGosta realized, with a strange, crawly feeling at the base of his spine, that he could feel, but not see, shapes moving toward them.
"There's only three of us, Lieutenant,"
Hayward said, tension suddenly evident in her dusky voice.
"May I suggest we get the hell out of here?"
There was a raspy call from out of the dark, then a shout and the sound of running. He heard a neigh of terror at his shoulder and turned to see Waxy, still transfixed.
"For Christ's sake, Captain, get hold of yourself!"
DeGosta shouted. Waxy began to whimper. From the other side, DeGosta heard a hissing noise, and he turned to Hayward's petite figure standing tense and erect. Her slender hands were at her sides with the knuckles pointed in, the towel and its burden dangling from her fingers. She took another deep, hissing breath, as if in preparation. Then she looked around quickly and turned back toward the staircase, once again holding the head at arm's length.
"Jesus, don't leave me!"
Waxy howled. DeGosta gave Waxy's shoulder a vicious tug. With a low groan, Waxy began to move, first slowly and then faster, bursting past Hayward.
"Move!"
the Ghosta called, pushing Hayward ahead of him with one hand. He felt something whiz past his ear, and he stopped, turned, drew his gun, and fired toward the ceiling. In the muzzle flash, he saw a dozen or more people coming up the dark tunnel, dividing, preparing to circle him. They ran low across the ground, moving with horrible speed through the darkness. He turned and fled for the stairway. One level up, on the far side of the hanging door, he stopped at last to listen, gulping air. Hayward waited beside him, gun in hand. There was no sound except the footsteps of Waxy, far ahead of them now, running down the rail siding toward the pool of light. After a moment, DaGosta stepped back.
"Sergeant, if you ever suggest backup in the future, or make any other suggestion for that matter, remind me to pay attention to it."
Hayward holstered her gun. "I was afraid you'd wig out down there like the captain did," she said. "But you did well for a virgin, sir." DaGosta looked at her, realizing this was the first time she had addressed him as a superior officer. He thought about asking just what the hell that weird breathing of hers had been about, but decided against it.
"Still got it?"
he said instead. Hayward raised the towel.
"Then let's get the hell out. We'll see the rest of the sight some other time."
On the way to the surface, the image that kept returning to DaGosta was not the circling mob or the endless, dank tunnel. It was the freshly soiled baby's diaper. 12. Margot washed her hands in the deep metal sink of the forensic anthropology lab, then dried them on a coarse hospital cloth. She glanced over at the gurney on which the sheeted remains of Pamela Wisher lay. The samples and observations had all been taken, and the corpse would be released to the family later that morning. Across the room, Bramble and Frock were at work on the unidentified skeleton, bending over its grotesquely twisted hips and taking elaborate measurements.
"If I may make an observation," Dr. Bramble said, putting a vibrating striker saw to one side.
"Be my guest,"
Frock replied in his buttery rumble, waving a hand magnanimously. They detested each other. Margot slipped two latex gloves onto each hand, turning to hide a smile. It was probably the first time she'd seen Frock face a man with an intellect, or an ego, equal to his own. It was a miracle that any work had been accomplished. Yet over the past few days they had performed antibody testing, osteological analysis, tests for toxic residues and teratogens, as well as numerous other procedures. All that remained was the DNA sequencing and forensic analysis of the teeth marks. Yet the unknown corpse remained a riddle, refusing to yield up its secrets. Margot knew this only added to the highly charged atmosphere within the lab.
"It should be obvious to the meanest intelligence," Bramble was saying, his high Irish voice trembling with irritation, "that the puncture cannot have originated on the dorsal side. Otherwise, the transverse process would have been clipped."
"I fail to see what clipping has to do with anything," muttered Frock.
Margot tuned out the argument, most of which was uninteresting to her anyway. Her specialty was ethnopharmacology and genetics, not gross anatomy. She had other problems to solve. She leaned over the latest gel electrophoresis run on tissue from the unidentified corpse, feeling her trapezius muscles cry out in protest as she reached forward. 5 sets of 10 reps with the upright rows the night before instead of her normal 3. She'd upped her workout routine dramatically over the last several days. She would have to be more careful not to overdo it. 10 minutes of close scrutiny confirmed her suspicions. The dark stripes of the various protein elements could tell her little beyond being common human muscle proteins. She straightened up with a sigh. Any more detailed genetic information would have to come from a much more sensitive DNA sequencing machine. Unfortunately, reliable results would not be available for several more days. As she placed the gel strips to one side, rubbing her shoulder thoughtfully, she noticed a manila envelope lying next to the Spark 10 workstation.
"X-rays," she thought. "They must have arrived first thing this morning."
Obviously, Bramble and Frock had been too busy arguing over the corpse to look at them. It was understandable. With a body that was almost completely skeletonized already, X-rays weren't likely to tell them very much.
"Margot,"
Frock called. She walked over to the examining table. "My dear," Frock said, pushing his wheelchair away and gesturing toward the microscope, "please examine this groove running down the right femur." The stereo zoom was on lowest power, yet it was still like gazing into another world. A brown bone leaped into view, revealing the ridges and valleys of a miniature desert landscape. "What do you make of this?" he asked. It wasn't the first time Margot had been called to give an opinion in a dispute, and she didn't relish the role.
It looks like a natural fissure in the bone, she said, keeping her voice neutral. Part of the suite of bone spurs and ridges that seem to have affected the skeleton. I wouldn't necessarily say it was caused by a tooth.
Frock settled back in his wheelchair, not quite able to mask a smile of triumph. Bramble blinked.
"I'm sorry?" he asked in disbelief. "Dr. Green, I don't mean to contradict you, but that's a longitudinal tooth mark if ever I saw one."
"I don't mean to contradict you, Dr. Bramble." She switched the stereo zoom to higher power, and the small fissure immediately turned into a vast canyon.
"But I can see some natural pores along the inside. Here."
Bramble bustled over and looked into the eyepieces, holding his old horn rims to one side. He stared at the image for several moments, then stepped away much more slowly than he had approached.
"'Hmm,'
he said, replacing his glasses.
"'It pains me to say it, Frock, but you may have a point.'
"'You mean Margot may have a point,' said Frock.
"'Yes, of course. Very good, Dr. Green.'
Margot was spared a reply by the ringing of the lab phone. Frock wheeled over and answered it energetically. Margot watched him, realizing that this was the first time she had really stopped to look at her old advisor since the Ghost's call brought them back together the week before. Though still portly, he seemed thinner than she remembered from their days together at the museum. His wheelchair, too, was different, old and scuffed. She wondered, in sudden sympathy, if her mentor had fallen on hard times. Yet if so, it hadn't seemed to affect him adversely. If anything, he looked more alert, more vigorous, than during his tenure as anthropology department chairman. Frock was listening, clearly upset about something. Margot's gaze drifted away from him and up to the laboratory window and its gorgeous view of Central Park. The trees were rich with the dark green foliage of summer, and the reservoir shimmered in the brilliant light. To the south, several rowboats drifted lazily across the pond. She thought how infinitely preferable it would be in one of those boats, basking in the sun, instead of here in the museum, pulling apart rotten bodies.
"That was DeGosta," Frock said, hanging up with a sigh. "He says our friend here is going to have some company. Close the blinds, will you? Artificial light is preferable for microscope work."
"What do you mean, company?" Margot asked sharply.
"That's how he put it. Apparently they discovered a badly decomposed head during a search of some railroad tunnels yesterday afternoon. They're sending it over for analysis."
Dr. Bramble muttered something in fervent Gaelic.
"Does the head belong—"
Margot began, then nodded in the direction of the corpses. Frock shook his head, a somber expression on his face.
"Apparently it's unrelated."
Silence descended on the lab for a moment. Then, as if on cue, the two men slowly returned to the unidentified skeleton. Soon murmurs of dissent began to rise once again. Margot sighed deeply and turned back toward the electrophoresis equipment. She had at least a morning's worth of cataloging to get through.
Her eye moved toward the X-rays. They'd raised a fearful stink with the lab in order to get them that morning. Maybe she ought to take a quick look before starting the cataloging.
She slid out the first series, clipping them to the viewer. Three shots of the unidentified skeleton's upper torso. As she expected, they showed, much less clearly, what they had already observed from direct examination. A skeleton suffering bizarre bone deformities with a grotesque thickening and ridging of almost every osteological process in the body. She pulled them down and slid the next series into the clips. Another set of three views, this time of the lumbar region. She saw it immediately. Four small spots, crisp and white. Curious, she swiveled the magnifier over for a closer look. The four spots were sharp,
triangles, arranged in a precise square at the very bottom of the spine, completely enclosed in a fused mass of bony growth. They had to be metal, Margot knew. Only metal would be that opaque to X-rays. She straightened up. The two men were still bending over the cadaver, their mutterings floating toward her across the quiet room. "There's something over here you should take a look at," she said. Bramble reached the viewer first and peered closely. He stepped away, adjusted his horn rims, and peered again. Frock rumbled over a moment later, curious, brushing against the medical examiner's legs in his haste. "If you don't mind," he said, using the heavy wheelchair to crowd Bramble off to the side. He leaned forward, face inches from the viewer. The room fell silent except for the hiss of air from the duct above the gurney. For once, Margot thought, both Bramble and Frock were completely baffled. 13. It was the first time DaGosta had been in the chief's office since Horlocker's appointment, and he gazed around in disbelief. It looked to him like a suburban steakhouse trying to go upscale. The heavy, fake mahogany furniture, the low lighting, the thick drapes, the cheap Mediterranean-style ironwork fixtures with the ripply yellow glass, it was so perfect it made him want to ask a waiter to bring him a Gibson. Chief Redmond Horlocker sat behind a vast desk, absolutely bare of paper. In the nearest wing chair, Waxy had settled his bulk comfortably and was describing their movements of the previous day. He had just gotten to the point where the three of them had been set upon by a mob of enraged homeless, and he, Waxy, was holding them at bay so that DaGosta and Hayward could escape. Horlocker listened, his face impassive. DaGosta's gaze fastened on Waxy, growing ever more animated as he talked. He considered speaking up himself, but long experience told him it wouldn't make any difference. Waxy was a precinct captain. He didn't get many chances to come down to one police plaza and impress the head honcho. Maybe the end result would be more manpower allocated to the case. Besides, a little voice in the back of DaGosta's head said, this was going to be one of those cases where the shit rain would fall especially hard. Even though he was officially in charge, it didn't hurt to let Waxy take some credit. The more visible you were at the beginning, the closer they mowed your ass at the end. Waxy finished his story, and there was a silence as Horlocker let a bit of gravitas build up in the room. Then he cleared his throat. "Your take, Lieutenant?" he asked, turning to DaGosta. DaGosta straightened up. "Well, sir, it's too early to tell whether there's a connection or not. It bears looking into, though, and I could use some extra manpower to..." The antique phone jangled, and Horlocker picked up the receiver, listening for a moment. "It can wait," he said curtly, then hung up and turned back to DaGosta. "You a post-reader?" he asked. "Sometimes," DaGosta replied. He knew where this was leading. "And you know this Smith back who's writing all the garbage?" "Yes, sir," said DaGosta. "He's a friend of yours?" DaGosta paused. "Not exactly, sir." "Not exactly," the chief repeated. "In that book of his about the museum beast, Smithback made it seem like you two were bosom buddies. To hear him tell it, the pair of you single-handedly saved the world during that little problem at the Museum of Natural History." DaGosta kept quiet. The role he'd played in the disastrous opening night party for the Superstition exhibition was ancient history, and nobody in the new administration wanted to give him any credit for it. "Well, you're not exactly pal Smithback is running us ragged, chasing down all the crank calls his reward offer has generated. That's where your extra manpower has gone. You should know that better than anyone." The chief shifted irritably in his huge leather throne. "So you're telling me that the homeless murders and the Wisher murder have the same M.O.?" DaGosta nodded. "Okay. Now, we don't like homeless being murdered here in New York. It's a problem. It doesn't look good. But when we get socialites being murdered, then we get a real problem. You get my drift?" "Absolutely," said Waxy. DaGosta said nothing. "What I'm saying is, we're concerned about the homeless murders, and we're going to try to take care of it. But look, DaGosta, we've got homeless dying every day. Between you and me, they're a dime a dozen. We both know it. On the other hand, I got a whole city on my butt about this headless debutante. The mayor wants that case solved." He leaned forward and put his elbows on the desk, a magnanimous look settling across his features. "Look, I know you're going to need more help on this, So I'm going to keep Captain Waxy here on the case. I've put someone else on the 24th precinct desk to free him up.
Yes, sir,
said Waxy, straightening up. As he listened, something inside DeGosta crumpled and died. A walking disaster like Waxy was exactly what he didn't need. Now, instead of more manpower, he'd have to nursemaid Waxy through every step. He'd better put him on some peripheral assignment where he couldn't screw up. But that led to a whole new chain of command problem, putting a precinct captain on a case being run by a lieutenant in the homicide division. Just how the hell was that going to fall out?
DeGosta,
the chief snapped. DeGosta looked up.
What?
I asked you a question. What's going on at the museum?
They've completed tests on the Wisher corpse and have released it to the family, DeGosta replied.
And the other skeleton?
They're still trying to identify it.
What about the teeth marks?
There seems to be some disagreement about their origin.
Horlocker shook his head.
Jesus, DeGosta. I thought you said those people knew what they were doing. Don't make me sorry I took your advice and moved those corpses out of the morgue.
We've got the chief and me and some top museum staff working on it. I know these people personally, and there aren't any better...
Horlocker sighed loudly and waved his hand. I don't care about their pedigrees. I want results. Now that you've got Waxy on the case, things should move faster. I want something by the end of the day tomorrow. Got that, DeGosta?
DeGosta nodded.
Yes, sir.
Good. The chief waved his hand.
Then get to it, you two.
14. It was, Smithback thought, the most bizarre demonstration he had seen in the 10 years he had lived in New York. The signs had been professionally painted, the sound system was first class, and Smithback felt distinctly underdressed. The crowd was remarkably diverse. Central Park South and Fifth Avenue ladies, dressed in diamonds and Donna Karen, along with young bankers, bond salesmen, commodity traders, and various young Turks eager for civil disobedience. There were also some well-dressed prep school teenagers, but what astonished Smithback was the size of the crowd. There must have been 2,000 people milling around him, and whoever organized the rally obviously had political clout. Their permit allowed them to close off Grand Army Plaza on a weekday rush hour. Behind a series of well-manned police barricades and ranks of television cameras were endless lines of angry traffic. Smithback knew that this group represented tremendous wealth and power in New York City. Their demonstration was no joke, not for the mayor, not for the police chief, not for anyone involved in New York City politics. These people simply did not go into the streets and hold demonstrations, and yet, here they were. Mrs. Horace Wisher stood on a large redwood platform in front of the gilded Victory statue at the intersection of Central Park South and Fifth Avenue. She was speaking into a microphone, the powerful PA system amplifying her crisp tones into an unavoidable presence. Behind her was a massive, full-color blow-up of the now-famous childhood picture of her daughter Pamela.
"How long?"
she asked the assembled throng.
"How long are we going to let our city die? How long are we going to tolerate the murders of our daughters, our sons, our brothers, our sisters, our parents? How long are we going to live in fear, in our own homes and in our own neighborhoods?"
She gazed over the crowd, listening to the rising murmur of assent. She began again more softly.
"My ancestors came to New Amsterdam 300 years ago. It has been our home ever since, and it has been a good home. When I was a little girl, my grandmother used to take me for evening walks in Central Park. We used to walk home alone from school after nightfall. We did not even lock the door to our townhouse. Why has nothing been done while crime, drugs, and murder have reared up all around us? How many mothers will have to lose their children before we say enough?"
She stood back from the microphone, collecting herself. A murmur of anger was beginning to ripple through the crowd. This woman had the simplicity and dignity of a born orator. Smithback held his cassette recorder higher, scenting another front-page story.
"The time has come,"
Mrs. Wisher said, her voice rising once again.
To take back our city. To take it back for our children and grandchildren. If it means executing drug dealers, if it means erecting $1 billion in new prison space, it must be done. This is war. If you don't believe me, look at the statistics. Every day they are killing us. 1,900 murders in New York City last year. 5 murders a day. We are at war, my friends, and we are losing. Now we must fight back with everything we've got. Street by street, block by block, from Battery Park to the Cloisters, from East End Avenue to Riverside Drive, we must take back our city.
The angry murmur had grown. Smithback noticed that more younger men were now joining the throng, attracted by the noise and the crowd. Hip flasks and pint bottles of wild turkey were being passed around.
Gentlemen bankers, my ass, he thought.
Suddenly, Mrs. Wisher turned and pointed. Smithback turned to see a flurry of activity beyond the barricade. A sleek black limousine had pulled up, and the mayor, a small, balding man in a dark suit, stepped out, accompanied by several aides. Smithback waited, eager to see what would happen. The size of this rally had obviously taken the mayor by surprise, and now he was scrambling to get involved, to show his concern.
The mayor of New York!
Mrs. Wisher cried as the mayor made his way toward the podium with the help of several policemen.
Here he is! Come to speak to us!
The voice of the crowd rose.
But he shall not speak. We want action, Mr. Mayor, not talk.
The crowd roared.
Action, not talk.
Action, roared the crowd. The young men began jeering and whistling. The mayor was stepping up to the podium now, smiling and waving. It appeared to Smithback that the mayor was asking Mrs. Wisher for the microphone. She took a step backward.
We don't want to hear another speech. We don't want to hear any more bullshit.
And with that, she ripped the microphone out of its plug and stepped down from the platform, leaving the mayor standing alone above the crowd, a plastic smile frozen on his face, deprived of any possibility of being heard over the roar. More than anything, it was her final expletive that caused the crowd to explode. A great, unintelligible roar rose up, like the sound of some vast, angry animal, and the crowd surged toward the podium. Smithback watched, a strange sensation rippling up his spine as the assembled group turned dangerously angry before his eyes. Several empty liquor bottles came sailing towards the stage, one shattering not 5 feet from the mayor. The groups of younger men had consolidated into a single body, and they began muscling their way towards the stage, cursing and jeering. Smithback caught a few isolated words. Asshole. Faggot. Liberal scum. More pieces of trash came flying out of the crowd, and the mayor's aides, realizing all was lost, quickly hustled him off the stage and back into his limousine.
Well, Smithback thought, interesting to see how mob mentality affects all classes.
He couldn't remember having seen quite so brief or so fine a display of mob oratory as Mrs. Wisher's. As the sense of menace faded and the crowd began dissolving into seething knots, the journalist threaded his way toward a park bench to jot down his impressions while they were fresh. Then he checked his watch. 5:30. He stood up and began trotting northwest through the park. Better get in position, just in case. 15. As Margot jogged around the corner onto 65th Street, her Walkman radio tuned to an all-news channel, she stopped short, surprised to see a familiar, lanky form lounging against the front railing of her apartment building, cowlick rearing above the long face like a brunette antler. "Oh," she panted, snapping off the Walkman and tugging the speakers from her ears. "It's you." Smithback reared back, mock incredulity flooding his features.
"Can it be? How sharper than a serpent's tooth indeed is a thankless friend.
all we've been through together, all that vast shared reservoir of memories, and I merit just an, oh, it's you?
I keep trying to put that vast reservoir of memories behind me, Margot said, stuffing the Walkman into her carryall and bending forward to massage her calves. Besides, whenever you run into me these days, it's to talk about one subject, my career and how great it is.
Ooh, a hit, a palpable hit, Smithback shrugged.
Fair enough. So let's pretend I'm here to make amends, Lotus Blossom. Let me buy you a drink. He eyed her appreciatively.
My, my, you're looking good these days. Going for the Miss Universe title?
Margot straightened up. I've got things to do. He caught hold of her arm as she maneuvered past him toward the door.
Café des Artistes, he said teasingly.
Margot stopped and sighed.
Very well, she said with a slight smile, disengaging her arm.
I'm not cheap, but I guess I can be had. Give me a few minutes to shower and change. They entered the venerable café through the lobby of the Hôtel des Artistes. Smithback nodded at the maître d'hôtel, and they made their way toward the quiet old bar.
Looks good, Margot said, nodding toward the quiche tray that was waiting to make its rounds among the tables.
Hey, I said a drink, not an eight-course dinner.
Smithback selected a table, positioning himself beneath the Howard Chandler Christie painting of naked women frolicking tastefully in a garden.
I think the redhead likes me, he said, winking and pointing his thumb at the painting.
An ancient waiter, his face creased by wrinkles and a perpetual smile, came by and took their drink orders.
I like this place,
Smithback said as the waiters shuffled away, a study in white and black.
They're nice to you in here. I hate waiters who make you feel like low-class shit.
He caught Margot in an interrogating gaze.
So, quiz time. Have you read all my articles since last we met?
I'll have to plead the fifth on that, Margot replied. But I did see your pieces on Pamela Wisher. I thought the second article was especially well done. I liked the way you made her out to be a real human being, not just something to exploit. New tack for you, isn't it?
That's my Margot, Smithback said.
The waiter returned with their drinks and a bowl of filberts, then departed.
I just came from the rally, actually, Smithback continued. That Mrs. Wisher is a formidable woman.
Margot nodded.
I heard about it on NPR just now. Sounds wild. I wonder if this Mrs. Wisher realizes what she's unleashed.
It became almost scary toward the end. The rich and influential have suddenly discovered the power of the vulgus mobile.
Margot laughed, still careful not to drop her guard. You had to be wary around Smithback. For all she knew, he had a tape recorder running in his pocket as they spoke.
It's strange, Smithback continued. What is?
He shrugged.
How little it takes, a few drinks, maybe the stimulant of being part of a mob, to strip a group of its upper-class veneer, make it ugly and violent.
If you knew about anthropology, Margot said, you wouldn't be so surprised. Besides, from what I heard, that crowd wasn't as uniformly upper crust as some of the press likes to think. She took another sip from her drink and sat back.
Anyway, I assume this isn't just a friendly drink. I've never known you to spend money without an ulterior motive.
Smithback put down his glass, looking genuinely wounded.
I'm surprised. I really am. That doesn't sound like the Margot I knew. I hardly see you these days. When I do, you talk this kind of trash. And just look at you, all muscled up like some gazelle. Where's the frumpy, slope-shouldered Margot I used to know and love? What's happened to you, anyway?
Margot started to reply, then paused. God only knew what Smithback would say if he knew she now carried a pistol in her carry-all.
What has happened to me?
She wondered. But even as she asked the question, she knew the answer. It's true, she hadn't seen much of Smithback, but it was for the same reason she hadn't seen much of her old mentor, Dr. Frock, or Kawakita, or Pendergast, the FBI agent, or anyone she'd known from her earlier days at the museum. The memories they all shared were still too fresh, too dreadful. The nightmares that still troubled her sleep were bad enough. The last thing she'd wanted was more reminders of that terrible ordeal. But even as she pondered, Smithback's hurt expression dissolved into a smile.
Oh, Gad, there's no point in dissembling, he cackled. You know me too well. There is an ulterior motive. I know what you've been doing, working late at the museum.
Margot froze.
How had it leaked?
But then she checked herself. Smithback was a clever fisherman, and there might be less bait on his line than he was letting on.
I thought as much, she said. So exactly what am I doing, and how did you find out about it?
Smithback shrugged.
I have my sources. You of all people should remember that. I looked up some old museum friends and learned that Pamela Wisher's body and the unidentified body were brought to the museum last Thursday. You and Frock are assisting in the autopsies.
Margot said nothing.
Don't worry, this is not for attribution, Smithback said.
I think I've finished my drink, said Margot. Time to go.
She stood up.
Wait!
Smithback put a restraining hand on her wrist.
There's one thing I don't know. Was the reason you were called in the teeth marks on the bones?
Margot jerked around.
How did you know that?
She demanded. Smithback grinned in triumph, and Margot realized, with a sinking feeling, how expertly she had been baited. He'd been guessing after all, but her reaction had confirmed it. She sat down again.
You're a real bastard, you know that?
The journalist shrugged.
It wasn't all guesswork. I knew the bodies had been brought to the museum. And if you read my interview with Mephisto, the underground leader, you know what he said about cannibals living beneath Manhattan.
Margot shook her head.
You can't print it, Bill.
Why not? They'll never know it came from you.
That's not what I'm worried about, she snapped. Think, just for one moment beyond your next deadline. Can you imagine what a story like that could do to the city? And how about your new friend, Mrs. Wisher? She doesn't know. What do you suppose she'd say if she knew her daughter was not only murdered and decapitated, but partially devoured as well?
A look of pain briefly crossed Smithback's face.
I know all that, but it's news, Margot.
Delay it one day.
Why?
Margot hesitated.
You better give me a reason, Lotus Blossom, Smithback urged.
Margot sighed.
Very well. Because the teeth marks may be canine. Apparently the bodies were lying underground for a long time before they were washed out in a storm. Probably some stray dog took a few bites out of them.
Smithback's face fell.
You mean it wasn't cannibals?
Margot shook her head.
Sorry to disappoint you. We should know tomorrow when the lab tests are finished. Then you can have the exclusive, I promise. We have a meeting scheduled at the museum for tomorrow afternoon. I'll talk to Frock and DaGosta about it myself afterwards.
But what difference will a day make?
I already told you. Break the story now and you'll cause an unholy panic. You saw those upper crusters out there today. You said so yourself. What happens if they think some kind of monster is loose? Another Mbonse? Or some weird cannibalistic serial killer? Then the next day we'll announce it was a dog bite and you'll look like an idiot. You've already pissed off the police with that reward business. If you panic the city for no reason, they'll ride you out of town on a rail.
Smithback sat back.
Wait just one day, Bill, Margot pleaded. It's not a story yet.
Smithback was silent, thinking.
All right, he said at last, grudgingly. All my instincts tell me I'm crazy, but you can have one more day. Then I get an exclusive, remember. No leaking the story to anyone.
Margot smiled slightly.
Don't worry.
They sat for a moment in silence. At last, Margot sighed.
Earlier you asked what's happened to me? I don't know. I guess these killings are just bringing back all the bad memories.
The museum beast, you mean,
Smithback said. He was methodically attacking the bowl of filberts.
That was a tough time.
I guess you could put it that way.
Margot shrugged.
After all that happened, well, I just wanted to put everything behind me. I was having bad dreams, waking up in a cold sweat night after night. After I went to Columbia, things got better. I thought it was over. But then I came back to the museum. All this started happening.
She fell silent for a moment.
Bill,
she said suddenly,
do you know whatever happened to Gregory Kawakita?
Greg? Smithback asked. He'd finished the bowl of filberts and was turning it over in his hands, as if looking for more underneath.
Haven't seen him since he took that leave of absence from the museum.
Why?
His eyes narrowed craftily.
You and he didn't have a thing going, did you?
Margot waved her hand dismissively.
No, nothing like that. If anything, we were always in competition for Dr. Frock's attention. It's just that he tried to reach me once, several months ago, and I never followed through. I think maybe he was sick or something. His voice sounded different than I remembered it. Anyway, I was feeling kind of guilty about it, so I finally looked him up in the Manhattan directory. He's not listed. I was curious if he'd moved away, maybe gotten a position elsewhere.
Beats me, Smithback said. But Greg's the kind of guy that always lands on his feet. He's probably moonlighting in some think tank, earning $300,000 a year.
He checked his watch.
I've got to file my story on the rally by 9, which means we have time for another drink.
Margot stared at him in mock amazement.
Bill Smithback? Buying a friend a second round? How could I leave now? History is being made here tonight.
16. Nick Bitterman eagerly climbed the stone steps of Belvedere Castle, then waited at the parapet for Tanya to catch up. Below him, the dark bulk of Central Park was spread out beneath a setting sun. Nick could feel the icy coldness of the bottle of Dom Pérignon creeping through the paper bag under his arm. It felt pleasant in the heat of evening. The glasses clinked in his jacket pocket as he moved. Automatically, he felt for the square box that contained the ring, a Tiffany-cut, one-carat diamond set in platinum that had cost him 4 large on 47th Street. He'd done well. Here came Tanya, giggling and gasping. She knew about the champagne, but she didn't know about the ring. He remembered seeing a movie in which two characters drank champagne on the Brooklyn Bridge, then threw the glasses into the river. That was pretty good, but this was going to be better. You couldn't get a more spectacular view of Manhattan than from the ramparts of Belvedere Castle at sunset. You just had to make sure you got your ass out of the park before dark. He grabbed Tanya's hand as she climbed the last steps, and they walked together to the edge of the stone parapet. The tower rose above them, black in the gloaming, its Gothic trappings humorously offset by the weather apparatus protruding from the topmost crenellations. He looked back the way they had come. At their feet lay the small castle pond, and beside it the great lawn leading up to the row of trees that shaded the reservoir. The reservoir itself was a sheet of beaten gold in the sunset. To his right, the buildings of Fifth Avenue marched stolidly northward, their windows flashing orange. To his left sat the dark outlines of the ramparts of Central Park West, in shadow below a layer of clouds. He pulled a bottle of champagne from its brown paper, tore off the foil and the wire netting, took careful aim, then wiggled the cork inexpertly out of the neck. They watched as it burst free with a loud pop, sailing out of sight. In a few seconds there was a splash as it hit the pond far below.
"Bravo!" cried Tanya.
He filled the glasses and handed her one.
"Cheers!"
They clinked glasses, and he drank his down in a gulp, then watched as Tanya sipped gingerly.
"Drink up!"
he urged, and she drained the glass, wrinkling her nose as she did so.
"It tickles!"
she giggled as he refilled the glasses, drinking his off again in a few quick gulps.
"Attention, citizens of Manhattan!"
he yelled from the ramparts, holding up the empty glass, his voice disappearing into space.
"This is Nick Bitterman speaking. I proclaim August 7th to be Tanya Schmidt Day in perpetuity."
Tanya laughed as he filled the glasses a third time, overflowing the rims and draining the bottle. When the glasses were empty, Nick wrapped his arm around the girl.
"Custom demands that we throw them off, too," he said sternly.
They winged the glasses into space, leaning over the parapet to watch as they flashed in a downward arc, landing in the pond with a splash. As he watched, Nick noticed that the sunbathers, roller skaters, and various park lounges were now gone, and the base of the castle was deserted. He'd better get the show on the road. Plunging his hand into his jacket pocket, he removed the box and handed it to her. He stepped backwards, watching proudly as she opened it.
"Nick! My God!" she cried. "It must have cost a fortune!"
"You're worth a fortune," Nick replied.
He smiled as she placed it on her finger, then pulled her to him and gave her a quick, hard kiss.
"You know what it means,"
he asked. She turned to him, eyes shining. Over her shoulders, the gloom was starting to gather in the trees. Well? He urged. She kissed him back and whispered in his ear. Until death do us part, baby, he replied, and kissed her again.